Hey everyone, and welcome to this special feature edition of the Risky Business Podcast. My name's Patrick Gray. This feature was made possible by the Hewlett Foundation's Cyber Initiative. The foundation has given us grant funding to produce this podcast series, which is designed to inform policymakers in cybersecurity, to educate policymakers in cybersecurity so that they can make better decisions. And this podcast is, I think, a special one, at least for me. Today, you're going to hear an interview I recorded with Mark Dowd. Mark is a world-renowned security researcher who I think was described in the New York Times as the Mozart of exploit design. Some years ago, Mark co-founded a company called Azimuth Security. Now, as you'll hear, the original plan for Azimuth was to provide security research and consulting services to software makers and vendors. But pretty quickly, Azimuth became a serious player in offensive security, selling exploits and other tools to government agencies in the Five Eyes countries. How big a player were they? Well, Azimuth and another Australian firm, Linchpin Labs, were acquired together by defence contractor L3 Technologies in 2018 for $313 million. I don't even know if that's Australian or American dollars, but that hardly matters because, yes, it's any way you slice or dice it, it's a lot of money. Now, a lot of journalists have wanted to interview Mark over the years and talk to him about this industry because the so-called O-Day market is obviously a topic that a lot of people are interested in. So at this point, I will have to declare that the only reason he's talking to me about this stuff in this interview is because we're good friends. I've known Mark for nearly 20 years now, so that does mean that there is an inherent conflict in me doing this interview. I'm not going to ask him a bunch of aggressive questions about being a dirty, no-good cyber arms dealer, but on the flip side, you'll get to hear him talk about what he can talk about, I guess, because, yeah, we're friends and he knows I'm not going to take his comments out of context or, you know, any of that stuff, which is a thing that happens when people talk about this topic. Over the years, Mark has been an invaluable resource to me on the technical side of things. He's helped to educate me on all sorts of stuff, always on background and never asking for credit, because he thinks informed debate and press coverage are important. And now he wants to do the same on the record, but talking about the non-technical aspects of exploit development and offensive security. Mark recently left his job at what had become L3 Harris, presumably to spend, my joke was presumably because he wanted to spend more time with his money. So yeah, we were able to record this interview with no one having to sign off on it or anything like that. And the interview touches on the history of Azimuth, what the public gets wrong when talking about O-Day and surveillance, and where this whole thing could go, especially considering writing memory corruption exploits, which have sort of been the gold standard for exceptional access, that's getting a lot harder and a lot more expensive. But Mark started off by explaining to me why he's doing the interview at all. Here he is.
Yeah, there's, as you know, a lot of kind of misinformation or semi-misinformation going around, not just from people on social media and Twitter and stuff, but a lot of reporting is very sensationalist. And while it makes for good reading, it can paint a picture about security, particularly offensive security, that isn't particularly accurate. As a result of that, a lot of people have an impression of this kind of industry that is not accurate. And for a lot of people, that might not matter that much. But, you know, policymakers and stuff eventually read this and factor it into their decisions. And so having no one there that can add a little reason to it is concerning.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, obviously, you and I are as one on this. Because nobody talks about it, right? Like offensive security when it comes to exploit dev and that sort of research, it's a little bit like Fight Club, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's changed over the years. Like it used to be a very taboo subject, much more so than it is now. And over time, it's increasingly gotten exposure. And there's been people now and then that have sort of spoken about their experiences in the industry and that. But it's still a very small representation, I would say, from people that have actually, you know, spent day to day or spent years working in that industry versus pundits on social media that talk a lot about it, but haven't actually ever been in the industry and are sort of drawing a long bow when they talk about various issues and also describe how things work.
And yeah, when you're sitting there, it must be frustrating when you're like, that's just wrong.
Yeah, it's not great. I mean, a lot of the time, and this is true of all press that is related to computer security, is a lot of the time it is not entirely technically accurate or something like that. And a lot of the time it doesn't matter that much. But when it's like an overarching and ongoing theme that comes out, and like I said before, important people are reading it and making decisions on it and things like that, then it can be a little concerning.
Now, I should explain to the listeners that this is something that you and I have spoken about doing for years, really years, but it hasn't really been practical for you to do it when you were still working for L3 Harris, which is the company that you sold Azimuth to. Now, I understand that you've still got some involvement there, but you've stepped back from the day-to-day operations of what was Azimuth and is now part of L3 Harris. But the way I wanted to structure this, and I really had to think about like, how are we going to tell this story? How are we going to draw out the insights? And I thought it might be really just worth telling your story, the Azimuth story, because it is kind of interesting how it came together. A lot of people would sort of assume that you set out to create like an exploit dev shop, but I knew you in the beginning and that's not really what you were trying to do, is it?
No, not really. We set out originally to do mostly consulting, particularly for vendors and stuff in application security, which is, you know, sort of the thing that we'd done a lot of in the past. And while I was aware that exploit dev was sort of, an opportunity, I didn't especially want to do it largely because I thought it was too stressful as a business model, which
funny.
I can tell you is correct. But I always thought that it was a possibility that we'd do it here and there, but not really as a primary business practice.
When did you start the company?
We started it at the very end of 2009.
Yeah. So I remember back then because it was actually my housemate, or in American English, roommate, who did your first website. I think I might have even helped out a little with the copy on your website. It was all about like, you know, we can audit your applications and stuff. And there was no mention of OFSEC. And some people have thought, oh, that's, you know, that's like subterfuge and deflection. But it really was the case that you actually bootstrapped the company. And I'll be careful what I say here, but you bootstrapped the company with money you earned doing a massive audit of a piece of software that is currently used by billions of people. So you took money from a large technology firm, did a huge audit, and then you're like, okay, let's keep doing that. Let's keep improving the state of the software that people use, right? Like that was kind of the vision.
Yeah, that's right. And after that, we continued doing, you know, application security, like reviews and things like that for a little while. It wasn't subterfuge as much as that was the original plan, followed by laziness to change it.
laziness to change the website, yeah.
Yeah.
But then, you know, you started getting pulled towards OFSEC, which is kind of the opposite of what the intent was. I mean, you know, you had it in mind, you do audit, security engineering, try to improve products. But it's a tough sell, right? Vendors don't necessarily want to spend bags of money on that. But I'm guessing before too long, you had a queue three deep of agencies, et cetera, that wanted to buy bugs and exploits. Is that about how it went?
The thing that I found really attractive about doing vulnerability research, apart from the fact that I happen to like it more than other things, is that there's no bunches of conference calls and documentation, like reams and reams of documentation. You just make an exploit and then go, here you go. And that's it.
Throw it over the fence and collect it.
Yeah, it was, in terms of business practice, it's actually a lot smoother than doing the traditional things where there's like 100 calls before it and then 20 follow-up calls and then huge documentation and things like that.
So was it the case that the agencies, you know, the customers, Azimuth's customers now, sought you out, or did you seek them out, or was it a little bit of both?
Initially, when we started doing it, I was seeking them out. We had like one or two contacts that were not agencies, they were sort of middlemen. And I didn't think that it was very good using middlemen, but I mean, we had nothing better at the time. And I was hoping to, you know, improve that situation as much as we could And so a lot of people sort of say to you like, oh, I can get you a really good book up here or there, but actually pretty much none of them can come through. And most people are saying it because they want a piece of, you know, any transaction. But eventually what I was hoping was that our work would speak for itself. And if we did enough of it, you know, if we did well enough at it, that people would come seek us out. So that was the hope. And one of the reasons we didn't really want to go through middlemen was because we didn't want to brandish someone else's reputation and improve theirs rather than ours.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. So what was it like as someone who's come from the, you know, civilian tech industry to then all of a sudden be navigating, essentially being a supplier to the intelligence community? Was that weird? I mean, I'm guessing it was a bit weird.
It was a little bit weird. I'd sort of indirectly been exposed to it before because other people that I knew were operating in that industry, and several companies in that industry had attempted to hire me in the past. So I'd sort of been exposed to it in a like from arm's length before. So I had some idea about how it worked a little bit going in. But of course, when you actually start working there, then you learn a whole lot of things that you perhaps didn't know before, or you'd made assumptions about before that were wrong.
Can you give us some examples? Because that's an interesting thing.
Yeah, so I guess basically how some of the tools are used and in what scenarios might not be as intuitive of you as you expect from time to time. And so we might design something with a certain use case in mind and find out that that's actually not really how it's intended to be used, and what you're doing is not helpful.
Yeah, okay.
And so you have to rethink it.
I mean, you know, I respect you enough to not ask you what specific use cases you're talking about, because then that's veering into slightly sketchy territory, I guess.
Yeah.
Speaking of sketchy territory, right? Like, as much as the, you know, public dialogue on this stuff can be a little bit overwrought at times, there are definitely some serious moral and ethical questions around developing and selling this sort of technology. This is something that you thought about pretty early on, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you don't really want to get caught up in a situation where you've sold something to people that you don't really, who you don't really know and you haven't really verified, and then they go and use it, and the next thing you read about in the news that some crazy human rights violation has happened, and the tooling that they're describing sounds an awful lot like something that you sold not very long ago. So it definitely was at the forefront of our mind to try and avoid that kind of situation and just sort of deal with places we were perhaps more familiar with and trusted.
So I believe the rule that you put in place pretty early on was that you would only deal with Five Eyes, the so-called Five Eyes countries. And I'm guessing that's because they have relatively similar laws, relatively similar, you know, privacy protections and warrant oversight, et cetera, et cetera, and intelligence oversight. I mean, was that why you decided to restrict to those countries, or was it also just a good business decision because the types of people that you were selling to care about who else has access to the tools?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little of both. They're sort of places that I'm most familiar with coming from where I come from. And, you know, I was confident with how they operate, or at least what their objectives are, and that, you know, they're democratic governments and things like that. But it also is, as you say, a good business decision. Like, it seems silly to draw the ire of the ruling bodies under which you live by dealing with their enemies. I mean, it just seems silly.
But it's not even their enemies, right? Like, it's even just some of those countries they don't care about that don't necessarily have good human rights records. Like, as you say, the last thing you want to do is read about some tool being used to track down activists or something, and then you're like, oh God, that sounds like our stuff. It's just funny that you're talking about having that realization like 10 years ago, and there are still people in this market now going, well, we've set up an ethics body, and they're still selling to tin pot crazy countries, right? Like, it's
bad. Yeah. And you know what, actually, a lot of the countries that have particularly bad human rights, it's not a hard decision not to sell to them, but like, the interesting thing is there's a whole bunch of countries that are not particularly enemies and also not particularly bad. So there is some temptation to go, okay, well, they're fine and everything. But we decided to just play it safe. And we really don't know the ins and outs of a lot of those countries. And, you know, we'll just
stick with what you know. Yeah. 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 I mean, that's it, right? Like you could, you know, sell to the French and then, you know, you don't really understand what their sort of geopolitical objectives are and how they might manifest in places of the world that, you know, France is active, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, just to pick one example, because we're enjoying shitting on the French in Australia this week.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to sell to them and then they get in a big fight with your country because you didn't buy submarines or something.
Exactly right. So look, I think we've hit on something interesting, right? Which is that the whole sovereignty thing is a real issue. Now, it's really easy for a company like yours based in a Five Eyes country to say, right, that's it. We're just going to sell to other Five Eyes countries. It's much more complicated for similar companies to yours operating in, you know, even in decent jurisdictions, they're usually quite small markets. So if you're like Italian, right, you can pretty much sell to the Italians, maybe a couple of other EU countries. But if you really want to make money, you're going to have to go global. And the types of organizations that are going to buy from your company are maybe not the ones you should be selling to. So I almost feel like I'm saying that you had a bit of a luxury by virtue of being Australia-based, that you could just make that decision and access really profitable markets without having to necessarily worry about the morals and the ethics bit. Would you sort of concede that?
Yes, I think so. I think a lot of companies that are based in Europe, generally, a lot of them tend to go for a market that they seem to be most comfortable with selling to NATO, which doesn't seem to have very many restrictions. But, you know, it's sort of where they live and what their jurisdictions are and things like that. And that's their market, I suppose. A few of them have neglected that to instead sell to Five Eyes, or some of them just sell to both. But yes, in terms of this particular market, where you have citizenship and when you were born can greatly affect your business model and your options. A company that starts in Israel has very different options than we might, or than someone might in Italy, as you say. And so where you're based will be a large factor in who you are selling to and what the available market is.
Now, that's obviously going to be a big part of this conversation, is the Israeli firms, right? And in particular, NSO, which just seems to be the pin-up child for the archetypal bad actor in this space, yeah. Right? Because it seems like NSO killed JFK, right? Like every time you sort of read about some malicious deed, it's always blamed on NSO.
That's right.
I mean, it's difficult to ask you to comment on what is, you know, what was until very recently a direct competitor of yours. Well, not really a direct competitor because they're in different markets, but, you know, a company that produced similar products to yours. You know, what do you make of all of the NSO coverage? I mean, do you accept that the coverage is by and large accurate? Do you think there's more to it? Do you think they need to change their behavior? Like, I'm just really curious to know what you think of NSO's alleged behavior.
Yeah, so first of all, I think I would say that I don't have any special knowledge of NSO that you don't. Like, I only have what I read. And so their actual business practices are, I mean, I can draw from both, you know, the media that I read and what I think is how the real market works and how they probably really work. I would say that it would appear that they do, or at least in the past and perhaps still in the present, don't seem particularly, scrupulous about who they've taken on as customers before. And they also seem to host attack infrastructure, according to a lot of articles, which is something that I personally would never venture into. I think hosting attack infrastructure, at least for me personally, is not something I would seriously consider doing because it just seems like a minefield. And
What you're saying is you were happy to develop the tools, but you did not want to actually operate the campaigns. You didn't want to run the campaigns, which seems fair enough.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I'm not an authorized government personnel who's able to do that kind of thing. And I think it would be crazy of them to allow me to do it on their behalf because they don't really know what I'm doing. Like, they wouldn't have control over it. And also, I expect that if I was operating my own attack infrastructure and got caught in a way that was embarrassing or criminal or something, they'd be quite quick to disavow me.
Yeah. So, like, speaking of that, though, like, since we're touching on that, I'm guessing what you developed was more the tools that would allow, you know, sort of like a platform that would allow them to essentially operate that infrastructure themselves. So you would develop, you know, there would obviously be an exploit component, there would be a payload component, there would be a server and collection component. I mean, is that about the long story short of it?
I can't really comment on exactly what we developed and what we didn't.
Okay, right. No, fair enough. Let's talk about just the proliferation thing, though, because when you started Azimuth, right, you started doing this sort of work. I mean, it wasn't a particularly big industry. There were a few players, right? Like, already there were quite a few players. They tended to be smaller shops. They were quite specialized. They had, like, long-standing deep relationships with one agency or another. But it's a business that went, you know, you essentially started as a few people and turned into a company that was acquired for hundreds of millions of dollars by a defense contractor, right? So you lived that experience of the maturation of this entire field. What do you make of the proliferation here? Because it does seem like it's, you know, I mean, as you said, policymakers are not necessarily totally well informed, but I'm guessing they look at the proliferation side of it and think, geez, okay, right, this is something that we need to get on top of. So yeah, what did you make of just observing the explosive growth in the sort of exploit dev world?
Yeah, so It definitely has grown a lot. When we started, it's sort of a dark market, like you said. It hasn't been talked about a lot, so we were aware of some of the competing companies, but we probably didn't have a complete picture, and probably still don't. But definitely over time, it's started to become more talked about and more acceptable to talk about in public forums. And new companies have sprung up. A lot of people have some kind of cyber capability that they've spun up. So it's become a very large or much larger than when we started, it seems. And with that, I guess you're right, comes concerns. And that's why there's so much policy discussion about it nowadays. Not to mention that as time goes on, you know, we're putting more and more data in harm's way, really. Like, we're putting more and more data, you know, on the internet and things like that. And so it becomes increasingly attractive for entities, whether they're government or not, like criminal organizations and stuff, to have access to this. And, you know,
well, it's that same old story, isn't it? Which is, as the internet gets more critical, so does security, both on the defensive side and the offensive side. It just becomes a more important piece of the world.
That's right. And if the data out there is increasingly attractive and valuable to you, then you're willing to pay more for someone to solve the problem of you being able to get it.
Mm. I want to bring up something now, which was you being essentially outed a few years ago by Vice. Mm-hmm. As a company that does this sort of work, right? Like, I know that this had been something that you'd been nervous about for quite a while, right? Because occasionally you'd tell me, oh man, you know, a reporter sniffing around and like, they're going to write about us and I really don't want them to. But eventually, of course, a story did come out that was really quite flattering. That was the one, of course, I think it was Lorenzo over at Vice wrote a profile on Azimuth. Yeah. And, you know, in the end, it was quite a flattering story, but I guess what I wanted to ask you is why you were so nervous about sort of being dragged out into the spot like that. Is it because you were worried you'd be tarred with the same brush as the sort of NSOs of the world?
Yeah, there's a couple of reasons why we would prefer not to have those kind of articles come out. One is a lot of public discourse on the offensive market is not nuanced. And so, yes, throwing them all into the same bucket is one concern we had. Second of all, it sort of makes you a target for, you know, other interested parties, and that's not very good at all either.
No, they might want to come along and, you know, even break into your office and steal your magic bag of Oday, right?
Yeah, and so there's that. And, you know, just that kind of scrutiny by foreign, perhaps well-resourced actors is not ideal.
Yeah. So I mean, it's funny, right? Because often people were like, oh, you know, why would he have anything to worry about, you know, from that sort of publicity? But it's pretty real when it's you, right? It's pretty real when you've got to worry about people with big budgets wanting to know what you know.
Yeah, that's not great.
All right, moving on from that. I know you got outed as well, allegedly, as being behind the unlock of the San Bernardino shooter's iPhone 5C. Now, I'm going to take a wild guess and say that that's something you can't confirm or deny.
Who can remember?
But I did want to mention that because at the time, and this is what makes it so funny, is you had probably, I mean, I'm guessing this was your most viral tweet that you ever wrote. Around that time, you actually wrote a tweet, which was a joke about accessing that iPhone, which said if the FBI really want to access the San Bernardino shooter's iPhone without permission, they should ask someone who's already done it, like U2. And of course, this is at the time when Apple had shipped a free U2 album with its latest iOS release, which everybody hated. Very funny. 30,000 retweets. So just the irony there was pretty deep.
Yeah, that was that is actually my most popular tweet ever. It's the most important thing I've ever said.
So look, let's talk in general terms right now, right? Like, so we've been sort of shading the public discourse here. We've been shading other reporters' work, right? And keep in mind, often they're working with limited information because, as you point out, it's kind of a dark industry, right? So not all their fault. They have to sort of fill in the gaps. Sometimes mistakes are made. But like what, you know, where is the public discourse on all of this stuff falling over, right? Because I'm really curious to hear what you have to say about that. Where are people getting this, their understanding of the sort of zero-day and access market, where is it falling over?
There's a lot of different areas that we could go into and talk about here. And actually, I've thought about talking about some of it in, you know, in an actual presentation before. But basically, the way that the public sort of anticipates that this market works and how it operates, particularly in in the countries that, the Five Eyes countries at least, is there seems to be this impression that firstly, various agencies just stockpile all these vulnerabilities that they keep sitting around, and then they just are free firing them whenever they feel like it at whoever they feel like it kind of thing. And it's crazy and irresponsible and everything, but that's not really how it works at all. Firstly, stockpiling doesn't make any sense because to create an exploit that continues to work, it requires quite a lot of maintenance work. And some of that maintenance work might require complete rewrites of the exploit periodically. And so if you have, say, 10 Chrome exploits, it's not particularly useful to you because you're
just
doing
creating a lot of maintenance work, right?
You're and doing of course, a huge amount of work.
And of course, if a vendor releases some sort of broad mitigation, they're going to crush all 10 at once, right? So that's another factor.
So if you were maintaining 10 Chrome exploits, for example, and some of them had similarities, you would be inclined to copy the techniques that you know that work. But if a mitigation comes out that destroys that technique, then all of your stockpile is gone. So why did you have stockpile in the first place kind of thing?
So stockpiling bugs is not something you feel is, that's not an accurate perception that bugs are stockpiled. They might have a little bit of depth throw, right? Like they might have other thing so that when that one gets squashed well, you can pick up with this other thing that you've been working on.
Yeah, I think a thin backup line is realistic and probably various agencies have knowledge of some bugs that they're fuzzed or something like that, but, you know, not really developed. And they're like, if we need to, then we can go back and look at this, for example. But stockpiling exploits doesn't really make any sense. And the other thing that I think is a big misconception is what I mentioned earlier, which is that these agencies are all just getting exploits and then firing them at whoever they like. But actually, there's a significant legal process for them to be able to deploy some of these tools, and not just that, but what they're allowed to do after that tool has been deployed. And, you know, police, for example, are allowed to search your house with a warrant, but they can't just go around smashing in every door and searching whatever house they like. Obviously, over history, that's happened from time to time, and that's when you need like policy and punishment to govern that.
I don't know if there's a serious, I don't know if that's a serious perception among the press, to be fair. Like, I don't know too many journos who think that You know, the FBI is just going ape shit with exploits. I mean, you know, they get in a bit of a twist over stuff like, like what do you call it? The network investigative techniques, which are dropped on like, you know, child exploitation sites served via Tor and whatever, which I think, you know, go for it personally. That's just my opinion. Yeah. But I don't think that's really a perception that a lot of press have that domestically.
I guess let me qualify it. I think that perception is held by a lot of discourse I see on social media and not necessarily the press that are generating the stories.
Twitter idiots. But yeah, I mean, maybe some coverage should focus more on the, you know, on the restrictions on the use of this stuff. But I mean, there's clearly someone we can blame for that. And it's Ed Snowden, who leaked a bunch of stuff that, you know, having spent a lot of time researching that stuff now, it seems pretty clear he didn't quite understand what he was leaking.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that I think he leaked that either he had a misconception of what it was, or he not just that he misunderstood what it was, but I don't think he was ever in a position where he saw how particular tools or technologies were used and just made kind of like assumptions about it.
Totally. I mean, that's exactly where I arrived at as well, which is that he didn't realize what some of the oversight is like. And, you know, when some of the journalists write that NSA is able to do stuff like access people's Facebook data without a warrant, I mean, that is true, but there is still oversight and it's maybe a little bit more rigorous than they realize, and certainly more rigorous since he did what he did. So in that sense, I mean, tighter oversight, probably a win, even though he's an idiot.
Yeah, so basically, when people are making assumptions about how a particular technology is used or something like that, their tendency is to relate it to whatever their preconceived notion was. So basically, when someone like Snowden sees a piece of technology and what it might be used for, he's more likely, I think, to assume bad faith than what the real picture might be.
That said, I think it is healthy to be suspicious of government agencies, and it's kind of like almost, you know, it's almost good to have that instinct fired up every now and then, even if it results in some dumb discourse. I don't know.
Yeah, that's right. Like I said, oversight and policy is something that's very important, and there should be, it's healthy to have a natural tug of war between the two different sides of we need to collect this intelligence, prosecute crimes or to worry about terrorism or whatever, and the privacy advocacy group saying, no, you're overreaching. I think while people tend to be on fairly extreme ends of that debate, the debate itself is healthy because it helps moderate and lend gravity to what various tools are capable of and how we should use them.
Yeah, I mean, them talking in worst case scenarios means we get to actually think about the worst case scenarios. And I think that is, I agree with you. I think it's actually valid. I think everybody, even if I disagree with a lot of the people who are most vocal about those sort of concerns, I'm really glad they're there, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's right. The only caveat I would add to that is that when people are on the extreme end of a particular side of this debate or of any debate, I suppose, and they're constantly producing hysteria, which makes you, I think, more inclined to ignore it.
Because that's the thing. Okay, so one thing that you haven't actually articulated yet, and I'm gonna articulate it for you, is the criticism of the press stuff, because you haven't really come up with a specific criticism of where they're going wrong with the agenda. So let me have a stab at it, okay? Which is that they seem to write stories that suggest that governments using ODAY at all is bad.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, for anyone with any depth of understanding of what these tools are, how they're used, and what they accomplish, the proposition that governments should stop using them is f***ing insane.
Yeah. To me, it's madness.
Yeah.
And
because like your enemies aren't going to stop, right? Like this is stuff that's used in the competition between states. If the United States says, right, that's it, no more ODAY, NSA, you can't use it. Like you think the Russians and the Chinese are going to be like, yeah, no worries. Like that's not how it works. These exploits are used to gather critical intelligence to disrupt terrorist plots that could claim countless lives. They're used to do some stuff like collect intelligence that's used for questionable practices, things like drone strikes, all of that, right? But like the idea that you can just not use them is f***ing cuckoo.
Yeah, so there's two things there in particular. One is you see people argue every now and then that NSA and similar agencies should just give all the bugs to the vendors and patch them and everything and not be doing offensive security, essentially.
But that's their job.
Yeah, which is completely insane to me because, firstly, as you suggest, your adversary nations would be like, thanks.
Yeah.
We have the ability to collect intelligence and monitor your activities, and you have no ability to see what we're doing, which is an extremely precarious geopolitical position, in my opinion.
Because there is some of the coverage does seem to imply that, you know, ODA use by governments is something that is out of control and needs to be checked. And like, they're plain face suggesting that ODA in and of itself is a threat. And it's just, like, the logic just as any, you know, as someone who's been in the field for a long time, like I can't even track the logic. It just doesn't make sense to me. It doesn't scan.
Yeah. Like, quite frankly, if they seriously didn't use tools such as, you know, exploits and things like that to gather intelligence, they would take the next logical step, which is to introduce and mandate legal backdoors.
I want to get to that in a moment, right? Because that's a conversation that you and me have had actually in a different setting, which is an interesting one, right? But like just back on this idea that like ODA equals bad, where do you think that perception comes from? It's almost like some of these commentators think that NSA is putting the bugs in the software, not just uncovering them. I think some of it, I think some of it comes from like the Shadow Brokers leak. And I think NSA probably f***ed up not reporting that SMB bug to Microsoft, right. The Eternal Blue. Like that one should probably have been, gone through the VEP. Yeah. And probably been submitted.
Did they even have that at the time? Probably not.
I'm not sure, to be honest. Like, but I mean, that's the thing, right? Like these days there is a VEP program, not just at NSA, ASD have one as well.
Yes.
But like, so here's a question, a pointed question on VEPs. Like as someone who's an expert in exploits, do you think a VEP is ever going to actually be used in good faith by an offensive team? Or are they just going to fudge the process so they get to keep their sweetest bugs?
It's really hard to say because I know of one or two examples in the past where remarkable bugs have been submitted through like by agencies. I mean, there was the Microsoft elliptic curve one.
Yeah, the one that got the pony just recently. Yeah, that was
yeah. That, like that's a crazy bug
to burn. Yeah,
that's must have hurt.
But I think they almost did that as proof that their VEP is something that they take seriously, right? They're like, look at this thing that we're setting on fire. Clearly, we're not keeping everything, right?
Yeah. And again, probably it depends on the country and the agency and all that kind of thing about what they're prepared to disclose and that kind of thing. But yeah, there's at least been examples of it in the past where they've submitted some pretty serious vulnerabilities. And I don't know what their decision process was for that, but it was a big call.
Well, I think the process seems to be like if this bug gets out, how much damage would it do, right? Like that seems to be a pretty core consideration in the VEP. But I think you can kind of argue that in different ways. That's why I sort of worry that they might fudge it a bit.
Yeah, and I mean, you could also apply a more cynical analysis, which is this has already been caught, we better disclose it.
yeah. Or our adversaries are doing this.
Found our adversaries with it, which I have no reason to believe that for that particular example. But you have no idea what the decision-making process is.
I mean, I guess, you know, it's difficult to add insight to the policy debate when we're just sitting here explaining why ODA is like just a fact of life. But
the other big factor there, because we were talking about intelligence agencies, and I also think it's a big deal for law enforcement agencies. I've seen people several times in the past say things like, well, they shouldn't have this. They should just do detective work the old-fashioned way, which is a ridiculous statement if you think about it, because the crimes that are committed nowadays are completely different than the crimes that were committed back then. Not all of them, obviously, but some of them. And they were also expensive and basically very difficult to solve. And now you have the best piece of evidence possible. And you're like, okay, we're just not going to. To me, it's like saying, well, you know, DNA is kind of witchcraft. We're not going to do that. Like, it's crazy to suggest that that's not an avenue that law enforcement should pursue, particularly when there's just so much evidence, like reams of evidence.
That actually brings us to this next part of this conversation, which, as I alluded to earlier, it's a conversation you and I have had actually quite a few times, just, you know, in regular conversations we've had, which is that, first of all, finding exploits for modern devices is getting really f***ing hard, which is driving the cost up. You're getting to the point now where you're going to be, like, without serious investments and a lot of R&D, you're looking at windows of time where there will be classes of devices where you won't have any access at all. And that begs the question, what do governments do at that point, right? Now, I mean, you have told me, and it's quite funny really, where, you know, you say it's not like they're just going to say, oh, okay, we'll just give up on the idea of accessing that data. You think, and I tend to agree with you, you think that at the point that it becomes prohibitively expensive and difficult for law enforcement agencies to exploit these devices, that that's when the real mandated backdoor conversation is going to begin. I mean, have I summarized your position well there?
Yeah, that's right. I think agencies and law enforcement and stuff require access, at least some access to these devices. And exploitation and stuff is a targeted and an expensive tool that they're not inclined to deploy recklessly, for the most part. And if that is no longer a effective technique, why wouldn't they? You've heard politicians bring it up quite a few times. They're like, well, why the hell wouldn't we just create a thing where we can access stuff as we need to? And other governments that are perhaps more authoritarian have already done this en masse, right? Like, oh, we'll just backdoor all our phones. I just don't see how you can say, all right, there should be no more zero day, and not think that you're not advocating for, okay, legal backdoors.
Yeah, you've got, I mean, I think the point that you're trying to make is that governments will not accept a state of affairs whereby they can't get access to devices.
Yeah, that's right.
But it could happen. We don't know. I mean, maybe they'll just keep paying the price of entry. But I mean, there was one thing that you said in your Hack in the Box talk recently, which was really interesting, which is we're kind of at an inflection point with the whole asymmetry thing, right? Because we've always said that hacking a piece of software it's easier to hack than it is to secure, and that's kind of inverting now. And we're maybe at a bit of a tipping point where it's going to be harder to hack some of this software than it is to secure it. You know, you'll need to put more effort into breaking than building.
I think you'll need to put certainly more effort into not getting caught.
Yeah. Well, that's another thing that I wanted to talk about, right? Which is like the way NSO, et cetera, keep getting snapped is because you got these groups like Google Tag now, right? Who are looking at all of the internet, like trying to find these types of exploits being dropped at, you know, on Uyghur Muslim community of interest websites and forums and things like that, right? So that's how they're catching that stuff. You got Citizen Lab going through activists' phones to find evidence of compromise, which is the reason that you've never had to lose any sleep over Citizen Lab, is because that's not where your stuff is going to turn up. As much as we're talking about, oh my God, look at all these people getting owned with O'Day, and this was something we wrote in our newsletter recently, the fact that this stuff is getting found publicly and burned is probably why we're seeing so much of it reported. Like, it's not like there's more O'Day now, it's just people are getting caught more.
Yeah, I think there's probably more players than there were in the past. But as I said, also, I think detection has improved significantly. As I suggested in my talk, getting caught, you know, perhaps 10 or 20 years ago was not really a large concern. The methods of detection and being able to root cause compromises and things like that was not very advanced for the most part. But as time goes on, you increasingly have various vendors in particular that have a broad scope where they can observe a huge number of events and sift through that with powerful, perhaps machine learning algorithms or rule-based algorithms, to say, hey, something happened that basically has never happened anywhere else. This is perhaps signal rather than noise, and being able to detect that kind of thing. And then on top of that, having groups such as the threat analysis group that you mentioned, that can employ having firstly access to a large amount of traffic, but also, you know, sophisticated detection techniques to try and catch malware in the wild. So I think increasingly over time, offensive players are going to have a hard time of being able to perform attacks without that compromise being detected.
So I think we've actually arrived somewhere, because this is for our policy focused series, right, on Risky Biz. And I think we've actually arrived at the policy lesson in this interview, right? And I think the policy lesson is it's getting harder due to better detection, due to better engineering. It's getting harder and more expensive for governments to procure ODAI to be used in law enforcement and intelligence activities, right? Mm-hmm. That's on a steepening trajectory, and you can foresee a time when access may become difficult and policymakers need to think about what that's going to mean for them.
Yeah, and there's something else I wanted to add about that. We were talking earlier about governments being somewhat inclined to move to legally mandated backdoors, which is useful to them for law enforcement purposes, but not particularly useful to them for intelligence gathering against adversarial nations.
Yeah, because as soon as you put in the backdoor, your adversaries stop using the technology.
Yeah, and this is something that I was trying to get at in my Hack in the Box talk as well, that increasingly I think the internet is becoming less and less integrated and global and more fragmented and balkanized because increasingly, this is one of the reasons, not the only reason, but increasingly I think foreign adversaries are a little more wary of the other's technology, and they're like, how much of our critical infrastructure or how much damage can be done by us having all this stuff on the internet? Maybe we should be pulling back a bit. Or how much of this stuff is being controlled by technology that's not being controlled by us? Maybe we should start pulling back on this. And I think that that's a trend that's going to increase.
But I mean, that'll have the effect of extending the status quo though, right? Because that means that when your adversaries are using Red Star Android, I mean, it's f***ing party time, basically. You don't need to a vulnerabilities equities process for finding a bug in like North Korea's Android clone. You know, it's a free fire zone, man.
Yeah, I often actually joke with friends that I was very disappointed that Turing didn't responsibly disclose the Enigma vulnerability. but that's an example of what we're talking about, right? As adversaries have their own technology and you're not using it, then it's a free-for-all. But that's not necessarily to say that technology is going to be easy to get into, because you know they're also increasingly cognizant of state-of-the-art security mechanisms that they need to have in place.
So they're building it for this purpose, right? So they're building it to be sort of interception resistant.
Yeah, and if you look at, for example, there's been a lot of press over the last few years about a hesitancy of Western countries to use Huawei equipment for, you know, major telcos and things like that. And in response to that, perhaps, and Huawei in the past has had a particularly bad security record, and people have often made fun of it, like their security, you know, their software security is terrible, blah, blah, blah. But they've actually invested a huge amount of resources into that. And now they're like, at least their phones are like, you know, some of the better and more secure technology offerings on the market. And so things that have had historically bad security get better over time, just by inertia, but also if there's an incentive, such as in this particular case, you saw that the tariff war with China and the US, and China starting to think, why are we using Android? This is a real problem for us, maybe, you know. And so
you're talking about the Huawei stuff that's not using Google Play services, like the post-sanction stuff, right? So that's, you've taken a look at that, and that's good, huh?
Well, no, there's a lot of it I haven't taken a look at. I have observed their security on their Android platform and their phone security over the past number of years. And it's got dramatically better, I would say. But also from reading the literature about Harmony OS coming out, and, you know, some of it might be kind of hype, so it's hard to say. But
it looks like they're making good decisions.
Yeah, like their intention is to create a truly network-based operating system with a microkernel architecture and this kind of thing, with very secure principles, things that we're familiar with, but we like the large-scale consumer market doesn't use, because I mean, there's been attempts to use it. Notably, Google has done Fuchsia and that kind of thing. But for the most part, everyone's like, it's too hard. Let's just use Linux.
You know, so I guess what you're saying here is a little bit more profound than the status quo is tightening up. I mean, you're talking about something bigger here, which is, you know, technology generally is getting better, more secure, particularly in mobile, right? Because that's really, you know, what you know best. And policymakers need to prepare for an environment where both their domestic agencies and their SIGINT agencies are going to have a hard time with access.
Yeah. So I've always thought, I sort of said this in my Hack in the Box talk, every year I'm like, this is it. We're not going to be able to do it after this. And then every year, you know, we sort of manage. But I think the face of access is changing. And like I alluded to in the talk, I think there'll be an increased focus on different kinds of access and perhaps different kinds of access tools compared to what we might see today. And, you know, those different avenues might continue to produce very useful tools for a significant time to come. But it's a little bit unclear at the moment how that's going to shape up in both the market of offensive tools and what the next generation of tools might look like, what their capabilities will be compared to what today's capabilities are.
Well, I know you're really interested in like CPU bugs and things like that, right? Like that's something you see as being potentially fertile ground in the future.
Well, you've seen a large uptick in, side channel vulnerabilities basically since Spectre and Meltdown and Rowhammer, which was not a side channel. It was a... But interestingly, I think a number of the side channel style vulnerabilities and Rowhammer were demonstrated as you could do this from a browser kind of thing. And so I think things like that will become increasingly potentially interesting as part of the offensive toolkit.
Go deeper.
Yeah, rather than just kind of interesting academic projects nearly. And, you know, some of them have been demonstrated to be effective in, you know, pretty real world scenarios. So, yeah, I think that's just one of the technologies where I think the access market will veer towards. But like you said, also in the policy world, if access tools fundamentally do different things than they used to, then policy will need to revisit that as well. And so what I mean by what they might do different. One is they might have different levels of access than they had before, probably less access. But secondly, you know, what you're doing with data. Increasingly, there's a very rich data set available to people who are able to get it, and very sophisticated or increasingly sophisticated kind of tools or analysis engines that can do, you know, large data set analysis and produce results that perhaps you're going to make significant decisions on. And so I think there'll be a lot of policy debate around things like what actually can we collect, what is permissible to allow these tools to do, and what decisions, how much faith do we have in them, basically.
So you're saying if we're going to start collecting a whole bunch of random stuff and try to infer meaning from it using machine learning, it's probably something we want to think about.
Well, I'm sure that a significant number of places are already there with this kind of technology. But it definitely is something that needs to be monitored, I would think.
Yeah. All righty. It's funny, too, when you mentioned the... you know, that every year you say, this is going to be the last year we can do this. Because I've known you. I mean, I've had that conversation with you a few times. And yeah. I always like it too when Apple drops some huge mitigation or something and then you look really stressed for like 2 weeks and then you look relaxed again. And I'm like, oh, he's figured it out.
Yeah. And a lot of these, when I have always said like, oh, we're not going to be able to do this anymore, I'm usually referring to really particularly memory corruption vulnerabilities, which is the main kind of thing that I've done. But
You were telling me too that some of the kids, like some of the stuff the kids are doing these days with like crazy, you know, cross-site scripting technique for full device access and whatever, like that stuff, that new kid way of doing stuff is really impressing you at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the aspects. I talked about microarchitectural flaws. I talked about things such as cross-site scripting, crypto vulnerabilities and that kind of thing. And I think all of these things are going to have increasing relevance in a standard offensive toolkit, because typically the reason they've been largely memory corruption focused is because memory corruption is very powerful, and it's basically applicable to most attack vectors. And, you know, there's...
It gives you the ultimate inflexibility, and once you get it, you've won, right? Like, especially once you've got a full chain, you can do whatever the f*** you want after that, right?
Yeah,
whereas these other things, you might be smuggling a bit of information out or doing this, or you can only do this or that, right? Yeah, no, it's a different thing. Code exec is king, like, no
and
doubt.
So if security gets to a point where you can do memory corruption, but you can't really get code exec, which is, it's sort of already there in a few isolated incidences, which I pointed out in the Hack in the Box talk, or that you can't really do something particularly useful with memory corruption, or you can, but not reliably. All of these things, or you can, but it's extremely expensive to maintain. You're rewriting the thing all the time. There's some point in time where you're like, okay, this is actually not more powerful, and it's also more expensive to do than this other thing over here.
Yeah.
And so I think that's where offensive toolkits will, offensive teams will increasingly go, we really need to know, you know, crypto better, or we really need to know side channels, microarchitectures better, or whatever it is.
The game is changing, but, you know, don't rely on the status quo forever, I think is, yeah, really the key lesson here.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Mark Dowd, thank you, really, for doing this interview, because I think it's about time, you know, we had something like this on record from someone who's been on the inside of this business for so long. I found this really illuminating and interesting hour. So thank you so much. And I hope we can do it again one day.
Okay. Thanks for having me.
That was Mark Dowd there, co-founder of Azimuth Security, talking about all things O'Day. Big thanks to him for that, and big thanks to the Hewlett Foundation Cyber Initiative for funding this work. And that's it from me today. I'll be back soon with more security news and analysis. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.